life, the wise things he did, the incredible challenges. And then we kind of looked at maybe a couple of missteps last week. And before we move on, I'm going to continue to look at those just a little bit longer. Remember when he first met Gideon, he was at the wine press making a little grain for his family. We watched him grow in confidence. I use the term, if you remember, faith-building activities. He went through seven faith-building activities. And each one made him a little more bold until he was able to take on the challenge that God had outlined for him. At the end there, we saw him take a little misstep that hurt his people and marred his legacy. If you remember what that was, he made an ephod, a priestly garment out of gold that he'd collected from the battle, and he put it up in his town, and they all went. It says they prostituted themselves before it and worshipped it. But I want to go back even a little bit further. It's interesting to me to think of when Gideon was at the wine press thrashing his wheat, and he decided with God's urging that he would follow God closely. Did you notice that he didn't join a band of other dedicated followers? When God called him, it was just him. He was the dude. There was not like 20 other people that he joined, and he had a lot of friends and camaraderies and encouragement. If you remember earlier when we looked at the life of Jesus, we said that early on he had thousands of followers, and then as he presented his kingdom, not of earth, but of spirit, it went down to 70 and then to 12 and then to 11. And then at the crucifixion, it was basically zero with a couple people hovering off in the distance. And then what we said there is the closer we get to God, sometimes the more alone we can be. And Gideon is pretty alone in this. And he made some pretty good choices, some pretty brave decisions. Unfortunately, most of us, I thought, when we were in terrible suffering from bad choices, rather than turn to God who can deliver us, we continue powerless in our suffering. We just keep doing the same thing over and over. Some of the heartaches that are shared in our prayer time, and I know some of the people involved, are people who just keep making the poor decision over and over, and they don't reach out to God. They don't reach to Him. Gideon at least reached out to God, trying to bring a nation back to Him. Remember the cycles in the book of Judges. I'm going to keep going over this every time, just so you have it memorized if you don't already. They went into sin. They fell into servitude, slavery. They cried out to the Lord, supplication. Salvation came. They were freed. And there was peace or silence in the land for a while. This was the pattern of centuries-old habits of pursuing other gods. We talked about why they could not break away from that particular weakness, that particular poor choice. We pursue other gods chiefly because the other gods let us do what we want. We define a God that allows all the choices we want to make, and that's the God that we choose to follow. We find a God that allows our flesh to exercise itself in the way it wants to. Or we define it that way. And by flesh, I mean our sin nature. It wasn't that these other options were superior. They weren't intellectually superior. They said, this makes a whole lot more sense. Is that they let the people be their own God, the God that they wanted to be. And it's always what we want. Isn't that what Satan offered in the Garden of Eden to Eve? You can be as God. It's easy to mock the children of Israel at this time, but I just can't help but see that we as a culture are in the same groove. Abandoning God to pursue our own line of thought, and it just leads to disaster. Remember that by putting that ephod in his town square, He was doing exactly what the nation had done for years and years and years and years with other gods. They put up the Baals and the Ashtaroths, and the people came to worship them. So it wasn't just an innocent memorial that he put up. He put this up, and the people immediately identified it with centuries-old practice of worshiping other gods. And so the people fall right back into the same habit. They just look at it. Not and to remember God's deliverance for them, which would have been okay. They look at it to substitute it for a relationship with God. And they worshiped the item or the creation rather than the creator. And then he said he wouldn't be king, that Yahweh would be king. But that decision that he made to put that thing there that the people would worship was probably worse than if he would have said he was going to be king. That would have been, you know, he would have been a pretty good leader. He was a pretty fair guy. He seemed like he made pretty good decisions. But then he makes another possibly even worse mistake than that one. And we touched on it just as we closed last week. And this is when he took myriad other wives. Remember in that day when a war went on, the men were often killed. The women were gathered up as spoil and became the possession of whoever conquered. It's not much of a life. By doing this, taking those people, having all those sons, it says he had 70 sons, he is licensing his sensual pleasure outside of the idea of how God created that relationship. We see many of these situations of concubines and other children in the Bible, and they do not work out well. They are some of the saddest stories in the Bible. It cheapens the relationship between man and woman and lowers the value of life. God meant a union of one man, one woman for life. Sin has messed this up. For many people, it's not what they choose. It's forced upon them. But when it can be upheld as the ideal, it should be. But to license it wholesale and to minimize the intimacy that God planned between man and a woman, to just have the relationships that he had, creates a low view of women and a competition among the offspring. And this is the disaster that Gideon brought in to the nation. Israel likes to make incredibly poor choices. They seem to continually do so. See, the idea of the gods of those days weren't a god that you had a personal relationship that you interacted day by day. It was one that you acknowledged and then went and did what you want. And some elements of Christianity are also practices, forms of what we would call the Christian faith, that we just acknowledge God for a moment and then do what we want for the rest of the week or the rest of the month. And then we come back and perform some series of I'm sorry, and then we do what we want again for the rest of the week. I don't know how many of you would think that was really an impressive personal relationship, but I doubt that many of you would. The intimacy between you and your spouse is one that is closer than that, and that would destroy that. And I think that that kind of intimacy is the kind that Christ is looking for in his followers. As the Christian base in our country begins to be abandoned and we see our country crumble, we don't turn back any more than they did. Maybe we'll turn back if a crisis comes. I don't know, but it doesn't seem like we might. We might just dig a little deeper and hope we can pull out of it. I heard this week, following the shooting in Florida, and they were talking about how to solve it. And I think it was the governor, but he said that, everything is on the table and will be discussed. And by everything, I'm sure he meant gun control and, you know, education and counseling and all that sort of stuff. But how many of you think that returning to God as the focus of our very existence is one of those things that was going to be on the table? See, we're just like the children of Israel in the book of Judges. We think that we're smart enough that we can pull this off. I know that sometimes I seem maybe sarcastic, or I try to be witty or clever or something, but I am a deeply emotional person as well. And when I see those images, I think of how drastically sad that is, that those things happen. And my immediate emotion is to cry out to the Lord. But it is not the emotion. I'm not sure I do it well. I'm not claiming that. But I'm saying it's my life pattern. But our country isn't doing that. I don't know how often we do it. And certainly the children of Israel didn't do it in these stories. But we follow the same life. Our lives are falling, the same pattern. Our lives are falling apart. But we won't repent and yield to His solutions. I work with young people a lot. It's so evident in a young person's life so often, the poor choices they're making, which are going to lead to total destruction. And you've seen it before. You've seen the pattern. You know, the road to Homer always goes to Homer, you know, I think, anyway, so far. So, and yet somehow they think they're going to be the one exception. They're going to do these things and they're going to be fine. Israel thinks that, well, I know that in the past they made these poor decisions, but we're going to be fine. Nothing ever poor is going to befall us. We hang on to our destruction. I'm not sure why, but we just keep hanging on. So now we move to chapter 9, which is just a brutal chapter. I don't know how many of you have read it in advance. It's a tedious chapter. It's a life is cheap chapter. And we're going to move through it pretty quick if I can, although it'll involve some reading to get the context of the thing. It's a sad conclusion to the legacy that Gideon could have had or should have had. In most of our lifetimes in Western culture, life has had value. We see that the old, the infirm, the child still has value in our culture. I don't know how much longer that will be the case, but it has for most of our life. But it doesn't take much of an historical viewpoint to look out and see that in the last century, the Soviet Union under Marxist-Leninist socialism, 60 million people at least were eradicated for the purpose of the government. The same in China. Untold millions in places we would never heard of. In our own country, millions in the forms of aborted children, as well as other countries. They're all disposed of because they're inconvenient. This is the standard procedure in these cultural times. And we see a very cheap view of life here in the beginning of this story. I'm just going to finish the last couple of verses of chapter 8 before we read into chapter 9. Gideon made that gold ephod and he set it up in his town, and all Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there. And it was a snare to Gideon and his family. Thus Midian was subdued before the Israelites and did not raise its head again during Gideon's lifetime, for the land enjoyed peace for 40 years. Gideon, son of Joash, went back home to live. He had 70 sons of his own, for he had many wives. His concubine who lived in Shechem also bore him a son, whom he named Abimelech. Gideon, son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abizarites. No sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals. They set up Baal-Berith as their god and did not remember the Lord their God, who had rescued them from the hands of their enemies on every side. They also failed to show kindness to the family of Gideon for all the good things he had done for them. And then if you have your Bible or you picked up the notes, we start at chapter 9, verse 1. Abimelech's son of Gideon went to his mother's brothers in Shechem and said to them and to all of his mother's clan, "Ask all the citizens of Shechem, which is better for you, to have all 70 of Gideon's sons rule over you or just one man? Remember, I am your flesh and blood." So soon they forgot Gideon's charge to them. Who did he say would rule over them? He said God would rule over them. God will rule over you. I will not, and my sons will not. This particular son seems to have ideas that he would could fill that role pretty well. Verse 3, when the brothers repeated all this to the citizens of Shechem, they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. They gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-Berith, and Abimelech used it to hire reckless adventurers. Worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Zerubbabel, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son, was left because he hid himself. And all the men of Shechem gathered together all of Beth Milo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem. Pretty compassionate fellow, wouldn't you say? The idea that he wanted that power bad enough to eradicate. We've all heard the phrase, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Very well lived out in Abimelech's case. The youngest brother who had escaped then told the parable as he stood at the top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and cried, listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, should I cease giving my oil with which they honor God and men and go to sway over trees? Then the tree said to the fig tree, you come and reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, should I cease my sweetness and my good fruit and go to sway over trees? Then the tree said to the vine, you come and reign over us. But the vine said to them, should I cease my new wine, which cheers both God and men, and go sway over trees? Then all the trees said to the bramble, you come and reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in truth you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. So the good people who were asked if they wanted to be king refused in this parable. And the one who was not to be trusted said, certainly I will do that. Now therefore, and he continues in verse 16, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt with Gideon and his house and have done to him as he deserves, for my father fought for you. He risked his life. He delivered you out of the hand of Midian, but you have risen up against my father's house this day and killed his 70 sons on one stone and made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, king over the men of Shechem because he is your brother. If then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Zerubbabel and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Milo, and let fire come from the men of Shechem and devour Abimelech. And Jotham ran away and fled, and he went to Beer and dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother. After Abimelech had reigned over Israel 3 years, God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the crime done to the 70 sons of Gideon might be settled and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem who aided him in the killing of his brothers. And the men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on top of the mountains, and they robbed all who passed by them along the way. And it was told to Abimelech. Now, I don't know if you're getting the feel for how nice this culture is, how nice this society is, that you want to live there. And yet today in our world, there are many cultures just like this. And it happens every day. You don't hear about it. And if the news knew about it, they probably wouldn't tell everybody. But this is a culture where life is cheap. Verse 26, now, Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his brothers and went over to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. So we see a little split come between this, the Shechem and Abimelech, and now this other guy shows up. And they went out into the fields and gathered grapes from the vineyards and trod them and made merry. And they went into the house of their God and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech. So he's no longer someone who they really find to be a great leader. Is he not the son of Gideon, and is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, but why should we serve him? If only this people were under my authority, then I would remove Abimelech. So he said to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. So we see a great civil war starting to rise up. Then Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his anger was aroused. And he sent messages to Abimelech secretly, saying, take note. Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his brothers have come to Shechem, and they are fortifying the city against you. Now, therefore, get up by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. And it shall be as soon as the sun is up in the morning that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do to them as you find opportunity. So Abimelech and all the people who were with him rose by night and lay in wait against Shechem in four companies. When Gaal, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the city, at the entrance to the city gate, Abimelech and his people who were with him rose from lying in wait. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, look, people are coming down from the tops of mountains. But Zebul said to him, oh, you see shadows of mountains as if they were men. So Gaal spoke again and said, see, people are coming down from the center of the land, and another company is coming from the diviner's terebinth tree. Then Zebul said to them, where indeed is your mouth now, with which you said, who is Abimelech that we should serve him? Are not these people whom you despised? Go out, if you will, and fight with them now. So Gaal went out, leading the men of Shechem, and fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled from him, and many were wounded. To the very entrance of the gate, then Abimelech dwelt in Arumu, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his brother so that they would not dwell in Shechem. I hope you get the flow here, and I hate to read this much, but I can't just expect you to know this by heart. So there's a couple more paragraphs here, and then we'll wrap it up. And they're brutal paragraphs. And it came about on the next day that the people went out into the field, and they told Abimelech. So he took his people, divided them into three companies, and lay in wait in the field. And he looked there, and there were the people coming out of the city, and he rose against them and attacked them. Then Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city. And the other two companies rushed upon all who were in the fields and killed them. So Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He took the city and killed the people who were in it, and he demolished the city and sowed it with salt. Now when all the men of the tower of Shechem had heard that, they entered the stronghold of the temple of the god Bareth. And it was told Abimelech that all the men of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. Then Abimelech went to Mount Zalman, and he and all the people who were with him. And he took an axe in his hand, and he cut down a bough from the trees, and he took it and laid it on his shoulder. And he said to the people with him, what you've seen me do, make haste and do what I have done. So each of the people likewise cut his own bough and followed Abimelech, put them against the stronghold, and set the stronghold on fire, so that all the people of the tower of Shechem died, about 1,000 men and women. Remember, we said life was cheap. When you choose to live this way, the brutalness of it, you can't trust anyone, because the same power you used to get hold of the power that you now have, the people around you are going to use to try to wrest that power from your grasp. Herein lies the trouble when we abandon God. We think we can handle it. Those men, if Shechem thought they could handle it, and the other guy thought he could handle it, and Abimelech thinks he can handle it. But there's six more verses in this, and let's look at the last six verses. Then Abimelech went to Thebez, and he camped against Thebez, and he took it. But there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women, all the people in the city fled there and shut themselves in, and they went up to the top of the tower. So Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it, and he drew near the door of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me, 'A woman killed me.'" So his young man thrust him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed, every man to his place. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers. And all the evil of the men of Shechem, God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Jotham, son of Gideon. It's a rough story. It's just the bedtime story you read to your children at night just before you tuck them in. Let me read you the story of Abimelech. You know, it's brutal. And brutal is the result, the end result of man seeking his own wisdom continually over and over. You noticed even as he's dying, he commits the ultimate form of stupidity. Rather than saying, "God, I have sinned. I am sorry. I am now reaping the result of my sin. Please draw me into yourself." He is concerned about his image, how he looks in history. Now, if he were around today, I would hate to tell him he doesn't look all that good. The story here is not all that flattering toward him. He felt pretty good about himself for a while. And yet in the end, he looked like a pretty sorry fellow. He has to have his own armor bearer take his life so he doesn't. By the way, that's a poor view of women again. You know, I mean, you can die at the hand of a man, but not at the hand of a woman, apparently, in those days. So I personally just as soon not die at the hand of either at this point. But death seems pretty much the same, whichever one comes. Abimelech was supposed to be a judge. He was supposed to be a good shepherd to the people if he was going to be a judge. That was the job of a judge, to be good, to provide justice to the people. He did none of those things. And the way he got his power set him up to fail automatically so that he could never get them. And we saw that in the life of Herod. If you remember when we studied Matthew, Herod killed all those relatives and his mother and his brothers and everybody else that he thought might take his power. This is what happens when we all of a sudden lose sight of God managing our life and think we have to manage all the details. We have to change our situation. Certainly we have a responsibility to do what we can do. But when it's beyond the scope of what we can do, we make fools of ourselves if we're confident in our own strength. We need to be confident in what God can do, what He is doing. I don't know how many of you think of the side stories to these stories, because we're reading about a couple of guys, but how many... all those people, families destroyed, either the whole family or part of the family. All those children without parents and parents without children and husbands without wives and wives without husbands. And it's just so brutal. Human nature, when it goes to an extreme, is so brutal. We saw that this week in the shooting thing that we were talking about. It's brutal. There's only one answer to take away from the brutalness of human nature, and it is not education. Certainly education plays a part. The beginning of World War II, Germany was probably the greatest educated, advanced educational culture in the world. And it didn't stop them from falling victim to the greatest brutalities in the world. Education alone, your thought processes are not going to solve this, because you are a fallen creature and your thought processes are not infallible. So we just have one simple option, and it really is quite simple, to throw ourselves back upon the God who created us, the infinite personal God who said He will help us through this existence to the point where we can come to be with Him forever. That's one option. The other option is just dig a little deeper and see if you can handle it. These stories are put in here for a reason. This church, I was thinking about this church is called Peninsula Bible Fellowship. And so I think we can read from the whole Bible then, right? Because it's all there for us. It's not just, you know, Ephesians Bible Fellowship or, you know, Psalms Bible Fellowship or New Testament or Old Testament. It's all of the Bible. If this was put in there for us, we are to learn from it. And we can learn from it as a culture as well as individually. Do not try to dig yourself out of your problems on your own. It never is going to work. It is never going to work well. You must fall back upon the Lord for the wisdom that you lack. And in doing so, begin to enjoy His goodness. And we would all hope for life to be a little better than this particular story is. So, fortunately, this is a hard story to wade through. So thank you for wading through it with me. And we'll, of course, all the stories in Judges are a little hard, but they're well worth looking at and learning from. Let's pray. God, you're really good to us. And as we wade through this story, we see that these people didn't acknowledge your goodness. They relied on their own goodness and just messed up everything they touched. Lord, help us to look back to you continually, back and back and back and back and back again, that we rely on you and not on our own strength. Thank you for your incredible grace, your patience, your mercy, to teach us so slowly and methodically over time. And we want to give you the credit for your goodness, though. In Jesus' name, amen.